Today, relations between Islam and the West have been strained by both mistrust and misunderstanding. Yet, there was a time when Muslim intellectual achievement was the envy of the world. In this part of the program, we'll be looking at the ways that Muslim mathematicians and scientists and inventors and astronomers helped set the stage for the European Renaissance, for the Enlightenment, and in fact, for modern society. And our guest is Michael Hamilton Morgan. He is the author of a recently published book. The title is Lost History, The Enduring Legacy of Muslim Scientists, Thinkers, and Artists. It's published by National Geographic Books, and I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Let me tell you a little bit more about Mr. Morgan. He's the author of The Twilight War and also co-author with undersea explorer Robert Ballard of a book titled Collision with History, The Search for John F. Kennedy's PT-109, also another book, Graveyards of the Pacific. He's a former diplomat. He created and now heads New Foundations for Peace, an organization that promotes cross-cultural understanding and leadership among youth. He has appeared on ABC, CBS, and as a Washington journalist, he's also covered foreign policy issues. And from 1990 to 2000, he directed and advised the International Pegasus Prize for Literature. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Morgan, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
You want to just take a moment and talk a little bit about the New Foundations for Peace and what that's all about?
Well, New Foundations for Peace is still very much a startup, but its purpose is to try and teach leadership skills around the world. A group of us back after 9/11 were looking at, you know, how we could make a contribution to the world beyond, you know, providing for our families and so on, and we decided we might try and convey the concept of leadership both here in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. And we have partners in a number of countries in Europe and the Middle East and Asia. But I took a leave of absence from New Foundations for Peace to work on this book and also a television project that's going to grow out of it, because I felt like we were sort of swimming against the tide. So much of the media coverage and public discussion right now is about the dark side of Islam and the threat and all that, that I felt like I needed to do some spade work in terms of better explaining this heritage of Muslim culture that most people in the United States are not aware of. I think in Europe there may be more awareness just because of a more shared history and closer geography, but not much context here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's interesting that you, in the introduction, talk about the fact that this project had its genesis in your experience writing a speech for an unnamed American business executive that was going to be delivered. You started working on this a little bit before 9/11,
right.
And then afterward, you know, then the idea of the speech was to talk about business.
Right.
And after 9/11, your feeling was, well, no, I can't do that. I can't do what I would have done before 9/11. And you decided that it would perhaps be a good idea to take this focus on the contribution of Muslim history, society, culture, whatever, to the West and its history, society, and culture. Was this something that before that you really hadn't spent a lot of time thinking about or researching about, were you exploring territory that for you really was new?
Well, yes, it was new, and now I'd heard the outlines of it over the years. My second language is Spanish, and all through high school and university, I studied Spanish literature, and the Moorish period was sort of a footnote there. The way it was presented to me, there wasn't much detail about it, and it was sort of a dark period that ended in 1492 when Isabella and Ferdinand expelled the last Moors from Granada. But in fact, that's almost the opposite of what I've learned later. In fact, the Moorish period was a phenomenal period of tolerance and invention and intellectual freedom. So I'd heard the outlines of it, but I didn't know the details. So this book was really a kind of a journey of discovery, and I went into it prepared to abandon it if I couldn't find the material that I needed, or if I couldn't support the premise of the book. But in fact, as I got more deeply into it, I realized that this was a story that needed to be told, especially in the context of current events.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to start off here, give some kind of example of a particular individual and what it was they did and what we owe to them. And somebody that probably for most of us, if we hadn't read the book or done this kind of research, we wouldn't know about this person.
That's right. Well, I think the easiest, my favorite starting point for that sort of question is a man named Muhammad al-Khwarizmi. I'm sure that most Americans have never heard of him, but a lot of people who work in information technology use a derivation of his name every day in their work in an algebraic tool that we call the algorithm. The algorithm, the word algorithm, it sounds Greek, and that was deliberately so because, you know, our mathematical heritage, we tend to talk about, you know, Pythagoras and Euclid, and go back to Greece, and it sounds Greek, but in fact, it comes from Mr. Al-Khwarizmi's name. He was a Persian. He lived in the 800s of current era. He was recruited to come to Baghdad to work for the great scholar Caliph al-Ma'mun, who was both ruler of the Arab Muslim Empire and a very accomplished intellectual in his own right. He was brought to Baghdad to do work in mathematics. The early Arab caliphs had been translating Greek and Byzantine and Roman and Persian mathematical texts. So they were very fascinated with numbers. They had a number of mathematical issues that they had to deal with. But Mr. Al-Khwarizmi, who comes from in the far eastern reaches of what's now Iran, comes to Baghdad, and he starts digging through the archives there in the Royal Library, and he comes across some very important materials that have actually been brought in from India. They've been translated into Arabic. They are several hundred years old, and he comes upon first a system of representing numerals, which what we call today the Arabic numerals, which are the numerals 1 through 9 that we use, 0 as well. Then he sees the zero, that concept doesn't exist in Greek geometry or Roman numerals, and then he also sees the use of negative numbers. So this sparks an intellectual explosion in his own mind, and he sort of weaves them into a coherent system, which is the foundation of modern higher mathematics. Then that's not enough. That's not all he did. He also develops a method of finding lost quantities that he calls al-jabr, which today we call algebra. And then, of course, I mentioned the algorithm, which is a very esoteric form of algebra. I looked in the American Academy of Mathematics for a definition of the algorithm, and they're still fighting about that. But essentially, it's what Google uses to drive searches when you enter certain characters. Algorithms make the search either work or not work. Algorithms are used by hedge fund managers to model financial flows and to allocate resources. But also, algorithms are the basis of modern software. So I like to say that the digital revolution wasn't born in Palo Alto or in Bangalore, India. It was born in in Baghdad in about 800 AD. He's a, you know, and we don't know very much about the man himself. We have some of his writings that were then translated from Arabic into Latin and then into the European vernacular languages. Mr. Al-Khwarizmi, until about 1600, was revered by European mathematicians. In fact, they would finish every mathematical postulate that they did with the Latin words dixit algorithmi, which means so says Al-Khwarizmi. They were so in awe of his mathematical abilities. Now, we've completely forgotten this man, but I would argue that he's had more impact on our everyday lives than Albert Einstein, who is an equally brilliant or even more brilliant mathematician. But I don't know that you could say that the theory of relativity really impacts on what we do every day. Mm-hmm. I can't even explain it, you know.
Yeah. Let me, in the introduction to the book, you talk about the fact that when you get into talking about these kinds of things,
right,
that you're going to find yourself inevitably drawn into arguments.
Yes.
Among people who find themselves in different camps.
Sure.
In the way that they think about this these very issues, the broad issue being, what was the contribution to world civilization and to European civilization of Islamic civilization.
Right.
And one of the groups, and I'm sure that you've heard this kind of argument before, would say that really what a lot of the things we're talking about here did not originate with Islamic Muslim thinkers,
right,
that they grabbed them from the Greeks, and that in fact maybe we can thank these people for the fact that we have them and they didn't get lost completely, but that in a sense that what they were channeling the Greeks for us. Now in this particular case of this mathematician, I think there's a good argument to be made that no, this he was not just doing something that had been done before. This was an original piece of thinking and work, but I wonder how you look at this more general sort of kind of analysis that says, well, yes, we should thank them for passing this material on, but that what they were doing was simply taking and mostly Greek science and maybe putting their own spin on it, but taking what had come before.
Well, I'm certainly aware of that frame of thought, because it's very predominant here, I think, in the United States. In fact, I was asked to respond to a commencement speech by, I believe it's Danny Pearl's dad, Judea Pearl, who said almost exactly that. I think he was speaking at the University of Toronto. And the weight of mainstream scientific history really is on the side you're talking about. But I would argue that when you really dig into it, there's an underlying, well, first there's a lack of information that has helped shape this viewpoint. And then also I think there's a wired-in bias that probably traces back to cultural religious disputes of a long, long time ago that modern-day scientists would be probably embarrassed to associate themselves with if they really saw the source of this viewpoint. But the fact is, until about 1500, European thinkers were very in awe of and respectful and towards the achievements of Muslim science, not just for the act of preserving Greco-Roman manuscripts, but also for taking those concepts and carrying them further. There's no way anyone could ever argue that algebra or the algorithm or trigonometry, these higher forms of math, came from Greece and Rome. No one could ever argue that modern orthodontia or suturing wounds or the invention of alcohol for antiseptic, more modern concept of infection and disease, just to name a few, came from Greece and Rome. Galen and Hippocrates were brilliant men, but they were working in a much more limited context. And so I think it's really a distortion of fact to look back to Galen and Hippocrates for our medical heritage and to ignore what Europe through Spain and Sicily and Venice and so on got from Muslim doctors. When you go back, you see that this relationship between Islam and not Islam is sort of a continuum of periods of conflict and then periods of coexistence, as well as exchange, collaboration, cross fertilization, and so on. Right now, because of phenomena like Al Qaeda, we tend to focus on the conflict side. We remember the Crusades, which, by the way, was started over on the Western side, not in the Muslim world, and then the battles in between the Ottoman Turks or wherever. But in fact, this I would argue that this, when you really dig into that viewpoint, that the Arabs and the Muslims only assimilated other people's ideas and then passed them on, it just doesn't hold up. I think it's profoundly disrespectful to the intellectual achievements of those people, and it shows an innate, I mean, it's almost a racist bias. Greece and Rome are okay, but when you get further south, that's the other, that's the enemy. Those are the bad guys. They didn't have good ideas. They just stole ideas from other people, and that's, my book is really intended to refute that. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do it in sound bites. I think you're going to have to really dig into the book to see the proof points. But this theory of holding Greco-Roman knowledge and passing it on has been called the refrigerator theory. It's basically saying that this huge culture that covered so many peoples and such a huge geography for so long couldn't do anything on its own other than hold on to some ideas from an earlier civilization and then just pass them on. I think it's profoundly mistaken and disrespectful.
We're going to take a caller here in just a moment.
Sure.
And continue to talk with our guest, Michael Morgan. Very quickly, I'd just like to mention again, there is a severe thunderstorm warning that remains in effect for about another 8 minutes. It was issued at the top of the hour, and this covers southeastern Morgan County and southwestern Sangamon County. This will be in effect until 11:30. So if you're in those areas, do keep that in mind. And also the possibility that there could be some severe weather here throughout the day. There is a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 3 o'clock this afternoon. And in our AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes these counties: Shelby, Christian, Sangamon, Clark, Cumberland, and Moultrie. So remember, that just means that there is a possibility for severe thunderstorms in and close to the watch area. And stay tuned here to AM 580. And when we have additional weather information, we'll pass it right on to you. And again, let me introduce the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Michael Hamilton Morgan. He's the author of a recently published book. The title is Lost History, The Enduring Legacy of Muslim Scientists, Thinkers, and Artists. It's published by National Geographic Books. We have a caller here to talk with in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Is your interviewer familiar with the book by Marie Rosa Menocal called Ornament of the World, How Muslims, Jews, and Christians Created a Cultural Tolerance in Medieval Spain? Our book club read it some months ago, and if I recall the conclusions correctly, it was a very synergistic environment during that period in Spain, and certainly there were contributions by Muslims at that time, but also by Jews and Christians to create that relatively short period of history where there seemed to be true cultural tolerance and a kind of integration which respected the individuality of each group.
I'm certainly aware of it. I think it's a beautiful book. In fact, it helped inspire me to get into this project, so I think it's a wonderful read.
Well, did you want to talk any further about that?
No.
Okay. Well.
Okay.
I appreciate the comments of the caller.
I would just add, this climate of collaboration, although this book only deals with medieval Spain, in fact. This happened in other places. I wouldn't say that it's universal, but for example, in medieval Cairo, under varying regimes, Muslim regimes, the same sort of climate of collaboration occurred at numerous times, and it caused a really rich output of science and literature and so on. Also in Turkey, as you might recall, when Queen Isabella expels the Jews and Muslims from Spain in 1492, the Turkish Sultan says, well, if the Spanish king is dumb enough to expel his smartest people, I'll be happy to welcome them, and he welcomes them to Istanbul. And so, on my various trips to Istanbul, my Turkish friends always take me to see the synagogues there. And but this sort of collaboration, I think, was probably more common than periods of conflict. But I won't say that they don't happen. There's intolerance woven throughout this history, just as much as there is understanding and cooperation.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to another call in a moment, but I have some more weather information for you. The Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Southern Christian County in central Illinois. That will be in effect until 12:15. At 11:23, National Weather Service meteorologists detected a severe thunderstorm capable of producing damaging winds in excess of 60 miles an hour. Here are some of the locations impacted: Morrisonville, Taylorville, Pena, and Assumption. So if you're in the path of the storm, get ready for damaging winds and possible lightning and so forth. Keep aware of changing weather conditions. And again, keep it tuned here to AM 580. We'll bring you new information as it becomes available. Again, this is a severe thunderstorm warning for Southern Christian County in central Illinois that will be in effect until 12:15. Well, let us talk again with another caller here, someone next in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Two questions and maybe a follow-up if I can. What was the religion practiced by Arabs prior to Muhammad?
Well, that's an interesting question, and that the answer to that is the very reason that inspired Muhammad to undertake what he did, and that was it was a real mix of faiths. The holy shrine there in Mecca, which is now the central holy site for Islam, the Kaaba was a holy site before Islam. And it was shared by several religions, including Christianity, Judaism, Mithraism, as I understand it, Zoroastrianism, and others that don't exist anymore. Pilgrims for these different religions would make a journey to the Kaaba there in Mecca to leave offerings. And the economy of Mecca was driven by this, and that's why when the Prophet Muhammad tried to persuade everyone to go over to one monotheistic religion, Islam, that there was so much resistance there, because the economy of the city was based on these pilgrimages from all sorts of different religions, and everybody thought they were going to go out of business. That was part of the resistance to what he was doing.
The other question is, the advent of Christianity and then of Islam, what were Westerners doing? We're talking about 1,700 years here from
right. The
dawn of Christianity and then the dawn of the Islamic faith.
Well, you know, Christianity essentially is created in the time of Jesus. He thinks he's a Jew, I think.
Yes.
But his followers gradually differentiate out from Judaism. So we're talking about, you know, the first years of the previous millennium, and then I think Rome adopts Christianity as the state religion in the 4th century,
yes,
if I'm not mistaken.
Constantine.
Yeah, and so then Rome proper falls to the barbarians.
And who were they?
Pardon?
Who were the barbarians?
Well, they were Germanic tribes coming down from north and east.
That's my point. These people were locked into primitivism. You know, they were still, I don't think they had much script. And now, in our time, the Western persona and intellect tends to discount all others.
Right.
But that's my point, that they, while these folk who were Arab, and Arabic in different phases of it, were, now isn't Mesopotamia, what we call Iraq today, isn't it the seat of civilization?
Well, it's certainly one of them. I mean, the Fertile Crescent and the land between the two rivers, Tigris and Euphrates, yeah, it was one of the, you know, that was Babylon and Assyria and so.
The Mideast there with the, and they had writing and building and all those things.
Sure.
And while our ancestors, yours and mine, in Western Europe were still wearing fur around
right.
themselves and living in mud huts and were lower on the advancement scale towards some sort of civilization. Now, here we as Western peoples, suddenly the Arabs are crazy, and we have the reference to Al-Qaeda, and we have all this nonsense. Well, when people are persecuted, and that's what the Romans had no backwardness about, and the Greeks too, persecuting Western Europeans, and they should have known the heel, you know, well enough by that time not to use it against other people. But we're right back to what you said earlier in this, your statement about what was good or what was bad for business. Mm-hmm. And that paradigm is worn out. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks.
Well, let's go on to another caller. This is back here where we are in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm calling to ask a question about the content of the book itself. I also want to say thanks, great show. But the first question asks, is there any overlap in your book between what is Muslim and what's African in terms of the contributions to mathematics? And then also, does it discuss the two invasions from the South? So the one invasion from North Africa, also including Arab culture, that occurred in the early 700, like 700 B.C., and then the second invasion, which we know of as the second conquering of Spain or southern Europe. And I'm only asking that because you talked earlier about the impact of modern racism and knowledge production.
Sure.
And then we also know the Roman practice of memoriam damnito, which speaks to the systematic erasure of these other cultures from mathematics and the appreciation that these other people have contributed to mathematics. So I'll hang up and take your answer. And again, thanks for being on the show.
Sure.
Sure. Well, because of space limitations, there are a lot of lost histories that I wasn't able to get into very fully in this book. The lost history of Africa, the lost history of India, the lost history of China. These are all major pieces of world knowledge that we're only now just rediscovering little pieces of. But I do, of course, I acknowledge in particular North Africa. In its role in the Arab Empire, and later it had also been part of the Roman Empire, the northern, or rather the southern coast of the Mediterranean. And then, you know, very brief mention of Mali, but in terms of the invasions, the first one you allude to, no, because my book only starts with the lifetime of Muhammad, which is the 7th century current era. But the second invasion, I give great focus to, first, the sort of very lucky initial invasion of Spain by a Berber leader named Tariq ibn Ziyad. He conquers Spain accidentally in the year 711 of current era, and that invasion and waves of it keep on going until 732 is really the high point of Arab presence in Europe, when they reach central France, about 150 kilometers from Paris, at a place we now know as Tours or Poitiers. And but for a very lucky break for a young Frankish general named Charles, who later becomes known as Charles Martel, the grandfather of Charlemagne, Europe probably would have had the same kind of Islamic influence that Spain does. But the larger Arab force was defeated. Actually, it withdrew. The leader was found himself surrounded and got killed. And the Arab and Muslim troops didn't know what to do, so they withdrew. And that started really the birth of modern Europe and the various dynasties that trace their line back to Charles Martel. But.
Do you think that the contributions that we're talking about here, contributions coming from the Islamic world, and particularly this time at the what a lot of people, I suppose, would say have been the golden age, the fact that we have forgotten them, do you think that it is a case indeed that they have been forgotten, or can you make the argument that in fact these contributions have been suppressed?
Well, it's, you know, I think it's a sort of a combination, and you have, there are many strands to this, but because Europeans were aware of Muslim intellectual contributions until about 1500 or so, I have to give them credit for being honest about it. I mean, Europe was very wary and distrustful or fearful of the religion of Islam, but they were also attracted to the intellectual achievements of the civilization. So they had sort of a dual relationship. After 1500, all sorts of things start to happen. The burst of the Renaissance and the age of imperialism and the age of enlightenment are so overpowering that they tend to drown out everything else. Because what happens in Europe is quite exceptional in human history. You just have a level of wealth and technological breakthrough and so on that, except for the various breakthroughs in Muslim civilization, Europe just kind of blows it all away. And after a while, Europeans start to think, well, we basically invented the world. And so history starts to get rewritten from that standpoint. Over here in the United States, we've just never had a strong grounding in the understanding of that period. When we talk about our national history and our intellectual and political and roots, we always look, well, the farthest back we go is Greece and Rome. And then we talk about this long dark age, and then all of a sudden this Renaissance bursts forth and Europe comes back to life. But we never talk about the other smart things going on further south and east. And I think it's just because of geographic remoteness and unfamiliarity. I know there have been cases where in the Muslim world where as the economic and political systems start to fall apart after 1500, there just isn't as much money to maintain the infrastructure of knowledge. Plus, say in Spain during the Inquisition, millions of volumes are burned by the inquisitors. When King Philip of Spain 200 years later tries to reconstitute a collection of the Muslim period in Spain, he has to go to North Africa, and all he can find are 15,000 books out of what were probably 3 million. When the Mongols invade Iran and Iraq in the 1200s, they just burn and destroy, especially Baghdad, which until then I would argue is the thought center of the world for about 400 years. They lay waste to it. They kill 800,000 people. It is just pulverized. So assorted, very awful events tend to wipe this knowledge out. As to whether there's deliberate erasing or editing of history, I think some of that's going on now among certain political groups, but I don't see it happening. And also in intra-Muslim disputes, factional sectarian disputes between Shiites and Sunnis and fundamentalists and liberals and so on, there is also rewriting of history. So it's a real mishmash, but it's hard to point your finger at any single person and say, you did it.
Mm-hmm.
But the cumulative result is that the history is lost.
Well, particularly since 9/11, there has been a lot written and said about the clash. I'm thinking here about what is, I guess, in shorthand known as the clash of civilizations kind of argument that looks at some kind of fundamental tension, or at least maybe tries to make the argument there's some kind of fundamental tension or incompatibility between Western European culture and the culture based in largely in, I guess, what we would call the Middle East of culture of the Islamic world. And that's that there are some people who are on the Western side who make this argument that underlying this, you know, this fundamental incompatibility is the idea that within Islamic culture and society, there is a distrust of intellectualism, of science, and of democracy. And that for that reason that they would say that there's, you know, that's the problem. That's what we're arguing about. We're arguing about those kind of things that we believe and that we say that they don't. Now, having said all that, I wonder, in fact, to what extent that's a misapprehension, or at least that you can't say those things of all of Islamic and Muslim thought and culture going all the way back to its beginnings, and that can you in fact say that there is something about either about the faith itself or perhaps about the culture in which it flowered that fostered intellectual curiosity other kinds of thinking and exploration, that it actually made it fertile ground for learning, for science, for culture?
Well, that's a whopper of a question. But in fact, the premise of my book is that there is no clash of civilizations, that the civilization that we inhabit today, that we consider Western or global, in fact was in large part initiated by that civilization. And so I think the intellectual lineage is very clear, and I hope I make that clear in my book, that there's a fairly unbroken line from the intellectual awakenings that happen in Greece and Rome and Persia, and then are intensified in Baghdad and Cordoba and Cairo and Isfahan and Delhi, and then spark things happening in Florence and Paris and London and whatever, and now in the United States. So I don't see that there are two civilizations. I think where we find ourselves now, you know, for 200, 300 years, the West has been sitting on top of the world, ruling the world through economic power, overt imperial power, military power, and at the same time, certain parts of the old Muslim world, some of them were under colonialism, for example, India, which in the year 1700 held 25% of the world's financial assets, by 1850, those assets have shifted to the British Empire. Mm. And what you have is and you can't universalize, remember, because we're talking about between a billion and 1.5 billion people who are Muslims today. I can't ever get an absolute number on that, but it's a huge amount of people, and most of the turmoil seems to be focused in the Middle East. Arabs only account for about 17% of all Muslims. So it's, once again, you got to be careful about generalizing. And then within the Arab world, not everywhere is in, you know, in crisis. But it's just really hard to support the idea of this clash of values. I think there are clashes between certain groups, but an innate civilizational clash, like all Muslims believe, you know, this is what life is, and the Westerners believe this, and so we're inevitably going to be drawn into war. No, I don't think that at all. I think most people on both sides, well, they just want to live their lives in peace. But there are certain folks who, for whatever reason, have other agendas. But I reject the clash of civilizations. I think there are people on both sides who would like to feed that impression and who would like to stoke it.
Yeah,
I'm trying to counteract it.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Okay. Our guest is Michael Hamilton Morgan. He is the author of a recent book. It is titled Lost History, The Enduring Legacy of Muslim Scientists, Thinkers, and Artists. It's published by National Geographic Books. So we're going to go on to some other callers in just a second. I do, again, just want to mention real quick that we do have a severe thunderstorm warning in effect for Southern Christian County in central Illinois. That continues for about another half an hour until 12:15. So just do keep in mind there is a possibility of some severe weather in our listening area, and then there is in fact a severe thunderstorm watch that will be in effect until 3 o'clock this afternoon for Shelby, Christian, Sangamon, Clark, Cumberland, and Moultrie counties. And if we get more information on the weather, of course, as soon as that becomes available to us, we will pass it on to you. And we have a couple of callers here. Let's go to somebody on a cell phone on line number one near Bellflower. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I got a question. Basically, how much of the conflict that's going on today, I was talking to a friend of mine who's from Iraq, actually, and what he was saying was he thought that some of what was going on today was due to a resentment of this feeling. What he was thinking was that since the Muslim world was so great in the past, and it is just not recognized, and it's like wanting to recapture that greatness and bring it back to the forefront. I guess I'm not really articulating the question very well, but try to bring that back, to try to bring the Muslim world back to the forefront, so that and bring it back to the former greatness.
Well, I think actually the question's pretty clear. I think you put it really well, and we'll let the guest respond to, whether in fact you think within the Muslim world there is both resentment by people that they feel that this past contributions are not being acknowledged, and also perhaps some feeling that this was at one time one of the world's great civilizations and could and should be again.
I think there's probably some of that involved. It's an open question as to how aware Muslims are of their intellectual heritage, because I'm getting lots of letters and calls for people wanting to know more who are Muslims and are unaware of it. I'm told conflicting things. Some people say, oh, everybody knows this history, and then other people will say, oh, nobody knows this history. So I'm talking about within Muslim countries. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that that's part of it. From my standpoint, I think that that's part of a larger sense of that is common in a lot of parts of the developing world of people feeling resentful of being sort of left out of the flow. You know, you could argue that people have to take some responsibility for where they are, but there are also larger forces at work that are beyond their power, and so they're just resentful of this feeling of powerlessness. But I meant to add from your previous question, David, that there is a strong strain of intellectual curiosity that does come from the faith. There's a statement in the Quran that I was unaware existed: the ink of the scholar is holier than the blood of the martyr. And then other statements about knowledge being the way to heaven and the way to distinguish good from evil. And so a lot of the early Muslim thinkers took these religious statements as permission to just take this thing to its limit, and that's what created this intellectual explosion in medicine, architecture, engineering, science, astronomy, mathematics.
Hmm. Well, that's I, unfortunately, as I often do, asked way too many questions at one time, but indeed that's getting at one of the important things I was thinking about, and that is, you know, take for example a city like Baghdad, which was an important seat of culture for a long time, and the question would be, well, let us suppose that those people were some other, you know, they were Zoroastrians or they were Hindus or they were Taoists or whatever, would it have been the seat of culture that it was if those folks were not Muslims but practiced some other faith?
Well, I think that, you know, even within the Muslim historical periods, a lot of the thinkers were not Muslims. There were a fair number of Jews and also Christians and then people of other religions or no religion. They weren't loud about it, but there were people, thinkers coming from everywhere, and they were allowed to do their work in general, not always, but this faith kind of provided a frame and a cohesion that the others hadn't done, the other faiths weren't doing. There was something in its nature that kind of created a larger universe for everybody to work in, so you had this huge space of land going from the Atlantic Ocean all the way across North Africa through the Middle East into South Asia and Southeast Asia that were sort of, and Central Asia, that were bound together by this common belief system, so that it created a kind of a super system for them to work in, and certain basic framework sort of a foundation to start from. So I don't know if the others could have done it quite as well.
Let's take at least one more caller here, Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to comment on this. I heard some analysis from a lecture about the whole contemporary situation, and this gentleman, who's Serbian-Canadian, pointed out that 75% of the current known oil reserves are under Muslim lands, not just the Middle East, but like Caspian region, in the Indonesian archipelago, and that sort of thing. And his thesis is that the West has to demonize Islam because it makes it easier for the exploitation to happen. And I think that's one to dwell on and think about. I don't know if you can handle it in a couple of minutes, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. You can comment on that any way you like.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. You know, it's hard to say whether, when you use the word Islam, you know, academics distinguish between Islam as a religion and then the broader, I use the term Muslim culture or civilization to distinguish between the broader culture and civilization, because my book really isn't about the religion except as how it influences intellectual development or did in history. But, I don't have much more to add to that.
Well, let me ask you this here. We've been talking in kind of general terms. Way at the beginning of the interview, I said, well, give us an example of some individual who you think was significant and people really wouldn't know about. And you named the mathematician Al-Khwarizmi and the man who was the father of the Arabic numeral system and, among other things, gave us the zero, something that the Greeks and the Romans had. They did not have that as part of their mathematics. So there's one individual. Just pick another person, perhaps, here that you might talk about for a minute or two.
Okay. Within the field of medicine, I want to talk about a wonderful medical thinker. He was also a Persian, Iranian, in current terminology. His name was Ibn Sina, S-I-I-B-N, meaning of the son of Sina, S-I-N-A. And the Western name that was given to him back in the medieval period was Avicenna. For Europeans, he was considered the father of European medicine until about, I guess, 1650 or 1700. And that's especially amazing considering that he lived in the 10th century. So he had a great influence for, 700 years. Muslim medicine started out from a different starting point than European Western medicine, which was, part of Europe. Europe was in a deep depression until, probably the 1200s, and it just didn't have the intellectual heritage of these places further south and east. But Ibn Sina, who was forced constantly to be looking for patrons and getting fired and being chased out of town when he lost favor, did some phenomenal things. He's given credit for being the first person to use inhalation anesthesia, and he used a solution created from poppies, which I guess would be either morphine or something like that. Mm-hmm. He also was the first person in history that we know of to state that tuberculosis was an infectious disease. But for me, what's most impressive about Ibn Sina is his work with the human mind. He believed that there was a connection between mind and body, and that you could often trace the roots of physical disease to something that was going on in the mind. In fact, he and some of his disciples started an early form of talk therapy, psychotherapy, which precedes Sigmund Freud by about 900 years. Now, psychotherapy, mainstream Western psychotherapy, does not exist until Freud, as far as I know. Prior to that, I think there were some, they were playing around with hypnosis and so on, but it had not developed at all. And this man was so far ahead of his time. There's one case where a young man comes to him, and he's been sort of shriveling away and losing weight, and he's obviously depressed. And through a series of question periods, Ibn Sina deduces that this young man is in love with a girl back in his hometown. So his cure is to tell a young man to go back and try and win her over, which has some risk. He might not succeed, but he does do that, and he finds the girl, and they get married, and he recovers his health and so on. I mean, it may sound simplistic to us now, but it was an important breakthrough in the concept of healing the mind. And it's part of it, the whole Muslim approach to medicine, as I said, started from a different point. They didn't come at it from the sin and damnation and demons and all that point of view. Even in the Quran, there are these very matter-of-fact statements about health and reproduction and the body and so on. So they don't have that baggage that impeded Europe's medical development for a long time. It was only, you know, really with the Renaissance that Europe starts to shake off these strictures. I mean, until 1600, it was forbidden to do dissections of cadavers. I think it was considered evil or sinful or something. But that was one issue the Muslims also had. They had problems with dissecting cadavers because it was considered to be desecrating the dead. But they managed to work around that. And Ibn Sina was only one of a number of phenomenal medical thinkers.
Well, we're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of the time. Much more to be found in the book. So if it sounds interesting to you, head out to the bookstore or the library and look for the book, Lost History, The Enduring Legacy of Muslim Scientists, Thinkers, and Artists, by our guest, Michael Hamilton Morgan. The book is published by National Geographic Books. Mr. Morgan, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much, David, and thanks to everybody who called in.